Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. I think most of our listeners know that Syria is in the midst of a civil war. As a measure of the seriousness of the situation, a Reuters report out yesterday says that the war has claimed the lives of 115,000 people. And with 5,000 of those deaths in September alone, it seems as though international pressure to eliminate Syria's chemical weapons hasn't slowed the war down at all. The UN reports that only 12 international aid organizations are approved by Syrian officials to work in country. One of those is Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières. This time on the Short Coat, we welcome back Dr. John Lawrence, pediatric surgeon and associate professor of surgery at the University of Vermont College of Medicine and formerly of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Dr. Lawrence has performed 6 surgical missions working with MSF, and he's come back to Iowa to talk about Syria, from which he's recently returned. Recently, medical students Jessica Galter, Catherine Ryken, and Ethan Forsgren sat down to talk to him about his experiences with MSF and in Syria. And I started us off by asking him how he became interested in global health and how he came to work with MSF.
So I think I would answer the first part by saying that my interest in global health really developed primarily in medical school, and in particular after my first year, I had the opportunity to do a 6-week research block in South Africa, and went over there thinking I was interested in studying nutrition, realized that I didn't really have any clinical expertise or any basis to be considering myself a serious researcher, but got exposed to the whole idea of how different medicine is in that part of the world, and I would say that from that, really it fostered my interest in wanting to do more and be involved more in that regard, and kind of translated that into my fourth year of medical school, going back to the same hospital and spending about 5 months, and then I really realized kind of with some clinical experience that this was something that I was very interested in, but also at that point that I wasn't really contributing very much, but learning quite a bit in the process. And so kind of made it a point when the opportunity arose in my career to want to be going back to be doing something in the global health realm, and then arranged in the beginning of my time as an attending physician a couple of short surgical trips in the range of 1 to 2 weeks, and some of those were very productive and I think I would say, beneficial, as well as always being educational. But some of them were less than well structured, and or there were various glitches that came up that made me think, gosh, maybe working with a bigger established organization would make more sense. And so then I evolved into applying for to work with Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, and got incorporated into their structure. And after the first mission, realized that they had an awful lot of positive attributes that have made me want to continue with that group.
Great. I think we're all kind of curious how you ended up in Syria. Obviously, we know a lot of the students know about the situation there, but maybe not so much about the medical side of things. So can you give us a little bit of a context of how you, arrived in Syria and sort of the overview of your trip?
Sure. So there was a little element of serendipity, but I think backtracking maybe first, obviously, MSF works in many different countries and in many different areas that are resource poor, that have conflicts or instability from whatever the basis. And so the opportunity to be there in particular wouldn't have existed if MSF wasn't there. That almost goes without saying. But in the particulars of working there, I have a side role working for MSF, meaning I have a full-time job, or in essence a full-time job, at the University of Vermont working as a pediatric surgeon, but had designated in my contract when I went there that I wanted to have 1 to 2 months a year to be able to be involved in global health projects. And so I've chosen to do most of those since I've gone there in working with MSF. And so I have kind of, the way that the schedule works, I'm one of 2 pediatric surgeons there, and so I work very closely with my my colleague in pediatric surgery about what times may be available for me to take off when there's not other activities going on. And then I, in turn, talk to the office in New York, which coordinates MSF's U.S. involvement, and say, here's a block of time when I think I could be available. And if you have, you know, a mission or a need for someone, just let me know. And so we work with the surgical coordinator down there. And so I'd had this block coming up in the, it was a more like 3 weeks originally, in between the latter part of August and early September, that I said I was available. And so probably three or four months previously, I'd said to her I'd have this time. And she, in turn, would then look for spots that would be available. So originally it was going to be going to a hospital in South Sudan, and it was a combined pediatric maternity hospital. And that facility, it turned out, really hadn't gotten their surgery program geared up at the time I was going. So she called me back about a month before I was to leave, and said, well, that's not going to work, but how about going to Haiti? We think there's going to be a spot where a surgeon's going to be going on vacation, and we just need to have you fill in for 2 weeks. And so that was sort of the second iteration of this trip. And then I got a call back about 2 weeks after that, and she said, well, actually, that we don't need you at that position, but we've got a spot in Gaza where we're looking for somebody. And then she was more explicit, saying somebody with pediatric expertise, but really more as a pediatric plastic surgeon rather than a pediatric general surgeon, which is what I do. And so I said to her, well, can you send me a case list of what they're looking for? And I had a chance to look that over, and it was a variety of kind of complex hand repairs and things that really don't fit my skill set well. So this is really more of a specialized surgical mission, which most of theirs aren't, but that particular one was. And I said, I don't think that's really going to work either. And so and it was getting down to, it was about a week or two before I was supposed to leave. And so she said, okay, let me see what else we have, and then called back and said, how about going to Syria? And in that regard, working with MSF, you always have the option to say no on a given position that may be offered to you. So if you feel that for whatever the reason it's too insecure, or there's some particulars about that that environment that you don't want to be in, you kind of have this right of refusal, and it won't be used against you. And I would extend that to say there are also projects that where MSF is working where they aren't sending Americans. So in Yemen, in Pakistan, up until very recently, Afghanistan was in that category, where they're really off limits to Americans because of safety and security issues. But anyway, so it all was kind of a bit of sort of a last minute, or close to the last minute, and not really a conscious choice in any way. But someplace, having said that just to the nature, I think, of the problems that have arisen there, and the I guess I would say the sort of the moral convictions that I might have about some place where I'd like to be working to maybe make some small statement or action in a positive direction against the situation that's there currently. So it meshed very well in that regard.
So we understand that you've been on 6 surgical missions now with Doctors Without Borders, and several of those have been in Africa.
Yes.
Would you be able to offer any comparison of Syria to other conflict zones, to other places that you've worked? What are the specific health challenges that you faced when you were in Syria?
Well, absolutely. So it really was, quite unique, I think I would say, in a lot of regards. And, probably the first thing that I would highlight is that as a country, before the conflict, Syria was really, I think, in many ways, a very well-developed in terms of, economy, healthcare mm-hmm. system, and a whole variety of other things. So when you are in Africa, typically the circumstance is that there's never been an opportunity, or the country's never really had the wherewithal to get a robust healthcare system or have the resources or funding to do that. And so the thing that was very striking, I think, was that the Syrian population was really used to a very high standard of healthcare before the conflict arose. And what's happened is that it's deteriorated and disintegrated as part of the conflict, partly because many physicians have left the country for their own safety, partly because the general turmoil makes it very hard for healthcare settings to have adequate supply chains and be able to get resources and the brass tacks of healthcare, pharmacy, medications, talking about the surgical realm, equipment and supplies, it's become very challenging to get those to the places where they need to be. And then I think, related to that, it also is now particularly challenging in that the healthcare systems have been targeted by the Syrian government as anyone who's been deemed assisting forces that are opposed to the Syrian government. There's been, I think, a tendency to select those particular hospitals mm-hmm. for attacks by the Syrian military. And so a lot of the infrastructure that was there has dissolved or diminished. And then you add into that the large number of Syrians who have been displaced into camps, more inside the country than outside the country, but the estimate somewhere around 4 million people, and the inability then to have any even basic healthcare services there. So you're meeting a need that's far bigger because of a population that's really in distress, combined with a lack of the existing resources being able to support what they could do previously.
So when you come into this chaos, this huge maelstrom of all the things you just talked about, what is it that you do? What were you doing specifically in Syria? How do you deal with all those things at once, or maybe you just choose a few?
Yeah, and so the mission or particular unit, group, whatever that I was working with inside the country had in essence, originally it was a hospital, and we say a hospital, but it was actually just a residence that had been converted into a hospital. But that hospital had one operating room, and it originally was set up to deal with any surgical needs that may arise, but primarily in its early months of existence was basically seeing primarily trauma and the sorts of things that you might expect in a conflict zone, so gunshot wounds and various other things, but also was taking care of more urgent surgical issues that exist anywhere that people are living, so cesarean deliveries and appendicitis and fractures and motor vehicle accidents or motorcycle accidents, whatever it may be, all those things were being met. And as time went by in this particular region, there's a group called Red Crescent, which is a kind of an equivalent of the Red Cross, I would say, in the Middle East. And so that group, which in the area or the city where I was in particular, had set up a hospital that had been funded by a very wealthy Syrian communications mogul, as a matter of fact. And then there was another government hospital that was about, and I say government, but another existing hospital in the healthcare system that was about 5 miles away. So collectively, what had evolved over the ensuing 6 to 8 months was that the Red Crescent specifically wanted to focus on taking care of the more of the war wounds and the kind of acute conflict the acute injuries that were coming out of the conflict, and they had were staffed with orthopedic surgeons and a whole variety of other specialists to really do that better than our facility was. And the other hospital in the community was really wanting to serve more as kind of the I would say generic community hospital, sure. handling more the common things that would still be coming through the door that would exist anywhere. And collectively, the decision had been reached to then make the hospital I was working at into a specialized burn center. So in essence, mm-hmm. our patients were all burn patients, and we had an emergency room, a very kind of modest or small emergency room that would see things broader than that, but the inpatient part of it was designed to be just specifically for burn patients.
So just going back to what you had been saying about hospitals and physicians being specifically targeted, how safe did you feel in comparison to other missions that you've been on, and did you ever feel like you were being specifically targeted?
What I would say is that from a security standpoint, it wasn't, particularly, unstable or insecure in the area. And I guess trying to rephrase that, there wasn't an active battles, kind of raging in the background of where I was working. But I think I would say it was probably more what I might say is perceived insecurity. So that, there had been you know, I think 4 months previously, a bomb had, fallen about a kilometer from where this hospital was, that kind of, broke all the windows and, slowed things down for a while. And there were, concerns of chemical weapon attacks that had been in the area and preparation made for that and various evacuation routes established. The area around the particular town I was in had a very sizable number of resistance fighters from that were presumed to be from Al-Qaeda. And again, it's not like people are wearing a specific lapel to identify them in that regard, but it was very clear that there were outside influences, and so there were an awful lot of do's and don'ts kind of established about what our role was to be, and it included things such as you go only between the residence and the hospital, which were about 20 steps away. You don't walk around town, you don't take photographs of anyone. So there were a lot of ground rules, and so having said that, I think I would say it really in all things considered felt pretty secure. And I think I would say another part of that is that there's a tendency when you're in a setting like that to just be focused on the task at hand as well. And so it's not, for any of us, whether we're students or, somewhere further along the line, you kind of wake up in the morning and you say, what do I have to do today? And that's what what you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. It's not, oh my gosh, I wonder if I'm going to get struck by lightning as I walk to my car, or, some other, more, if I can use the word, random events that may occur. Sure. So I think that it's not that it was a really sort of an overwhelming thing, and again, a lot of precautionary things done to sort of, give reassurance to you that as much as possible, every kind of contingency had already been thought about or addressed, and probably far more than you might be able to be thinking of.
Absolutely.
You mentioned some of the specific cases that you were working on, but I was just wondering, with MSF as a whole, what type of goals do they have for the country of Syria? And we've seen a lot in the news as far as, the nerve gas and different things happening. Just overall, what are the health issues going on in Syria right now?
Yeah, and I think, answering to what MSF's role specifically is, I think the biggest part of it is going to be to try to, in whatever way they can, facilitate healthcare to, those in need. And so, in a broader sense, they, ideally, view themselves as being quite impartial. And their role in the country currently, primarily their action or their activity is in rebel-controlled areas, but they also are supporting facilities in government-controlled areas, just because the entire healthcare system has really, suffered so badly in the whole conflict. So I think that a large part of their motivation is just to do what they do most any place that they do become involved, which is to try to prop up, maintain, or provide basic health services, no matter what the circumstances are that the individual may be in need of them. And then secondarily, they have, I think, a somewhat unique and at times, this being a case in point, of controversial role of also feeling that they need to speak out when they think that access to health care or humanitarian support in general is being blocked or hindered or unduly impaired. So their concept of neutrality, they think, should make them and other organizations be able to be involved. And obviously, that's been very challenging in Syria. And so, in late August, after the event where the sarin nerve gas was dropped in Damascus, they had an episode where they then spoke out, and the ramifications of that, quite significant, in that it was shortly viewed by the U.S. and France that we've now got, independent verification that the Syrian government has clearly, been behind these. And they actually, their original announcement, they then kind of backpedaled a little bit because it wasn't a direct observation, but kind of people they'd been working with who reported this. That backpedaling didn't quite make as much news as the original announcement did, but they, you know, they do have, I guess I would say, sort of an ethical overtone to their work, which is to say, you know, if you are, you know, kind of taking, you know, either denying the possibility of aid or utilizing aid supplies and things in an inappropriate fashion, that they will, you know, take that, you know, maybe up to a point, but they don't allow that to go on in indefinitely. And so there, if you want to use the word sort of advocacy for human rights issues, is another part of what they do. And the reason that the group actually formed originally, having split off of the Red Cross now, you know, some 40, a little more than 40 years ago, that's one of the differences, is that they will engage in those kinds of, you know, policy statements if they think that it's necessary. But in truth, they really try to limit that as much as possible and kind of let things play out and not become an active role player in those kinds of issues.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting looking at, you know, the publicity materials of MSF and talking about this fine line that they have to walk, like you were speaking to, about engaging in publicity and then also not at the same time. I noticed there was even like a noticeable absence of human rights rhetoric in the publicity materials. And could you talk more about walking this fine line, maybe some of MSF's history with human rights and how it engages with that?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's lots of, you know, examples and an area, I guess I would say, backtracking just a little bit, of where sensitivity to these matters is something that's examined, you know, very carefully. And so, you know, I think that at a superficial level, there's, you know, most of us tend to kind of fall into the mindset, well, you know, a humanitarian group like that, NGOs, they're all good. They, you know, couldn't possibly have any downsides or have their the support that they provide turned and used in a what may be negative fashion. But a variety of different, you know, I think I would say, incidents or events have started to change that thinking, and, you know, really a fair amount of criticism has been directed at various humanitarian rights groups, NGOs, and again, one could probably argue justifiably, where their intent or purpose or what they're trying to do is really, you know, muddied the waters or maybe been not as productive as one may want it to be. And the kind of one of the real classic examples of this was in Rwanda after the genocide, where, you know, many of the people who perpetrated that then left the country and went into the Congo, where they were living in camps for displaced individuals and intermingling very closely with them and benefiting from the aid that MSF and other groups were supplying, and using that aid to then strengthen themselves to actually go back and sort of keep stirring the pot and a whole variety of other, you know, negative events that came out of that.
Did you see any of that play out in Syria when you were there? Like,
yeah, so I would say, you know, no. I mean, I didn't see the, you know, that sort of thing going on. But I think you could, you know, there's a whole, you know, line of dialogue, I think, that goes along the thinking that, you know, there's a potential for any humanitarian aid group to possibly prolong a conflict. If you're providing support and you're doing that potentially for, you know, rebels who are trying, you know, may have a very justifiable cause, but if you're allowing them to, you know, continue their efforts, that may, you know, may not necessarily always be a good thing, and may get you, as in another example, when you know, talk about Somalia and aiding various groups there, and there's, you know, been sort of a, you know, opportunities for, you know, taking aid funds directed to aid, and many times the aid in ideally going to civilian population, ideally, who have been, had their health care needs increased or been displaced or whatever it may be, but that, you know, a group that's overseeing those kinds of individuals then saying, well, we're going to actually take some of this aid resources and or money, demand money to, you know, to further our own cause. So it gets into a very slippery slope of where do you say, well, when is what we're doing gone from being really a good and positive and clearly everybody sees the logic behind it to where, you know, might this be a somewhat grayer zone in terms of how beneficial it is or what the role might be?
You know, this might be a bit of a challenging question, but talking about humanitarian aid and based on your personal experience, what do you think is specifically needed in Syria right now? How can people help?
Well, I think, you know, my answer to that would be, you know, probably could, you know, give that at a couple of levels, but I think, and, you know, maybe I'll even take a step back and let me just kind of finish my thought here, I guess, on all this. But so first off, I would say, you know, the idea of supporting or, you know, providing funds, and, you know, and again, it sounds, you know, almost, you know, sometimes people think, well, what, you know, I as an individual may be able to do really isn't going to make a difference. But, you know, and I don't mean to be plugging specifically for MSF because they aren't the only group that's there, but, you know, something as simple as a donation, you know, how does that group keep going? Well, it's really not something where, you know, and I won't pick on him, but, you know, Bill Gates gives $1 billion a year to it to kind of keep it subsisting. It is the bulk of the money raised comes from people who give $5 a month or $10 a month, or they have a, you know, a bake sale or something like that, and the proceeds go to it. And it's very easy to say, well, gosh, that really can't make a difference. But, you know, maybe you could, you know, take that analogy to, you know, recycling or global warming and say, well, gosh, if I ride my bicycle to class today instead of driving the car, that really doesn't make a huge difference that anybody could see. But if you collectively, everybody has that mentality, you really can make a difference. So I think, you know, trying to support, you know, anybody who is making efforts there, and the sort of the easiest way to do that literally would be fiscally. You could certainly make, you know, then argue that although the recent chemical gas attack, you know, it was a, you know, very tragic thing, I must say the more I've thought about that, the more I think it may have been the single most beneficial in the long term event that occurs there, because it's drawn the whole world's attention in. And mm-hmm. again, hard to say where the discussions that have been started may lead to, but if you compare that to some other places, and you know, if you compare that to Darfur, where those sorts of activities of an air force going and bombing civilian populations, which is the sort of thing that, you know, is happening in Syria right now, you might say, well, why doesn't this end? And part of it is that, you know, it's not quite enough of an atrocity, or it's far enough off the radar screen, it's not developed enough a country where we seem to care about it. And, you know, hard to say how you might pull that together, but the, you know, that recent, you know, that recent single event may do more for political mediation than if the conflict had continued along as it was, where it just seemed like everyone was kind of content to sit on the sidelines and observe. And I guess I would say, you know, in terms of advocacy, what else can we do? And I think, you know, one of the few powers that we have, but you know, it also shouldn't be lost sight of, is our, you know, political process and the right to advocate through, you know, whoever it is that represents us in the Congress and the Senate. And again, you might say, gosh, it's kind of hard to get much momentum or traction in that regard, but it's, you know, I mean, those people do listen if there's enough of a voice for, you know, advocacy in that regard.
So I understand that you've said Doctors Without Borders' role is really acute. It's mainly intervention in crisis situations. But I think we all know that the chronic effects of warfare are upon a civilian population for decades afterwards. And I personally have seen, like, a lot of similarities between, you know, the Bosnian War and Syrian War, where both populations experienced a high level of healthcare and a high level of infrastructure prior to the onset of civil war. And so I guess, what kind of health problems can you predict for this Syrian population 20 years down the road?
Yeah, well, and I think that, you know, probably a variety of ways that one could answer that. But I think that, you know, a big part of it may be that it may take almost that long to get back to, you know, some reasonable semblance of a functional healthcare system, to be honest with you. So I think that you're you know, as we talk about healthcare globally, just as a human rights issue, I think that you know, most of us feel like that should be an innate right of anybody in the world, no matter where they are. And the reality is, it's not distributed equitably. But having said that, you know, I think there's probably nothing more tragic than a place that had a pretty high level of function that is now stepped back from that mm-hmm. level. And I think, you know, long term, that will be a big one. I think probably a second one will be in the mental health realm, to be honest with you, because mm-hmm. there have been a tremendous number of people traumatized. And again, if you want to use the word PTSD or however you may want to impart that as a specific what diagnosis or a term you want to apply for it. But, you know, there's have been, again, an innumerable, easily a third of the population whose lives have been turned completely upside down. And whether it's loss of children or other family members, you know, witnesses to atrocities, disruption from, you know, a stable residence to living in a refugee camp and all of the things that are, implicit in that. So I think there's, you know, any number of potential problems that long-term could spin out of that. And then I think finally, the last thing that may very well be an issue, and, you know, here I'm going to say I'm much less of an expert, but obviously this recognition that there's been, by the Syrian government, that there's a huge amount of chemical weapons that are stockpiled and stored, and from an environmental standpoint, you know, what kinds of effects may that have? And then, you know, related to that, the other thing that one's, often sees in settings like this is unexploded ordnance. And so it's mm-hmm. mining. And, you know, and again, I don't know that that's happened extensively in Syria, but certainly isn't uncommon to see that in a lot of countries where a conflict has been, it's resolved, but there's all these unexploded mines that have, you know, literally generations of impact on a population because they're not easy to detect and get out. And, right. and again, we won't make any editorial comments about a certain country that's initials are USA that has been advocated against signing treaties that right. almost every country in the world other than us has signed that says that these shouldn't be manufactured. But I think any or all of those areas would be long-term problems.
I just also wanted to ask if you have any opinion on the averted American military strike on Syria, and what's your opinion on what's currently going on with getting Syria to give up all of their chemical weapons stores?
Yeah, I think that, on to the, American bombing, it was interesting being in the country at the time that was being proposed, and even we didn't do a lot of political probing, to be honest with you, or opinion taking of the people around us. But there were some Syrian colleagues that I was working with that, got a chance to sense of what their perspective was. And again, this being in a rebel-controlled area, they were generally advocating that, thought it would be a good idea. And I think, in particular, what they were hoping was that they could dismantle the Syrian Air Force. I'm not sure it was against selected individuals, but if they could at least stop the ability for the planes randomly to, used as, dropping bombs of, whether it's standard materials or chemical weapons, that was viewed. So again, that's sort of a very broad generalization, and it's not, if I sampled 10 people, there would probably be 10 very different answers. There
right.
clearly is the side that says, what do you gain, if you're trying to, minimize the loss of life, what do you gain by taking more, seemingly? And then the whole non-selectiveness, of course, of bombing and realizing, yes, that, the U.S.'s military has the ability to target and be very specific, but the reality is it's never going to be completely specific. And we hear, obviously, the whole issue of drone attacks and Pakistan and Yemen and other places, we're aware that those aren't always targeted or, affecting the people they're trying to target. And so there's the term, which doesn't sound very, doesn't have a very personal ring to it, of collateral damage, as if it's, if that's you or your family, that's pretty darn significant. And so I'm kind of steering off the answer to the question, I guess I would say, but, you know, my take on that is probably, I mean, would be to say personally, I think it's probably a good thing that that, you know, did not wind up coming to fruition. In particular, I think it also may have just sort of made things more inflammatory in the area for all the people who are involved and what would be, you know, Iran's or the Soviet Union's or, you know, Israel's response to what spun out of that. And rather than, I think I could have seen that evolving into something that escalated more and more and got more difficult for people to stand back and say, wait, let's, you know, stop and think about this. And then in turn, the fact that we're now getting, you know, UN inspectors into the country or, you know, I guess, you know, beyond the UN now, this group from Amsterdam, the Netherlands, that's now actually gone into the country, I think, as of yesterday and started to verify where the various sites are and actually start to work on on trying to, you know, de-arm them or whatever one uses those with chemicals. I think I would say, you know, that's all very positive, realizing that's not an assurance that, it, you know, it's going to happen completely or that every agreement that's been brought forward you know, or discussed will come to fruition. But I think it's, you know, hopefully that's all a very positive step, which, again, I don't know if we would have gotten to quite this quickly if the bombing had all occurred. But, you know, obviously hard to know.
Speculation.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for listening to The Short Coat. The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from medical student government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by Revolution Void. Thanks for listening.